Another bullet bellowed, and a shot kicked up dust at his feet. Matt swung his gun and blasted at an open window, then started for the saloon door. He stopped, hearing a loud cry behind him.
"Matt Saber?"
It was Sykes. His eyes flared widely. Saber hesitated, glanced swiftly around, then dropped to his knees in the silent street. "What is it, Tony? Anything I can do for you?"
Behind the desk.
His faltering voice faded. Then strength seemed to flood back, and he looked up.
"Good man. Too fast."
And then he was dead. Gone just like that. And Matt Saber was striding into the yellow jacket. The upstairs room was empty. The stairs were empty. There was no one in sight. Only Hobbs stood behind the bar when he came down. Hobbs, his face set and pale. Saber looked at him, eyes steady and cold. "Who came down those stairs?" Hobbs licked his lips. He choked, then whispered hoarsely,
"Nobody, but there's a back stairs."
Saber wheeled and walked back in quick strides, thumbing shells into his gun. The office door was open, and Prince McCarran looked up as he framed himself in the door. He was writing, and the desk was rumpled with papers, the desk of a busy man. Nearby was a bottle and a full glass. McCarran lay down his pen.
"So? You beat him? I thought you might."
"Did you?" Saber's gaze was cold. If this man had been running, as he must have run, he gave no evidence of it now. "You should hire them faster, Prince."
"Well," McCarran shrugged, "he was fast enough until now. But this wasn't my job anyway. He was working for Reed."
Saber took a step inside the door, away from the wall, keeping his hands free. His eyes were on those of Prince McCarran, and Prince watched him, alert, interested.
"That won't ride with me," Matt said. "Reed's a stooge, a perfect stooge. He'll be lucky if he comes back alive from this trip. A lot of that posse you sent out won't come back either."
McCarran's eyelids tightened at the mention of the posse.
"Forget it." He waved his hand. "Sit down and have a drink. After all, we're not fools, Saber. We're grown men, and we can talk. I never liked killing anyway."
"Unless you do it or have it done." Saber's hands remained where they were. "What's the matter, Prince? Yellow? Afraid to do your own killing?" McCarran's face was still, and his eyes were wide now.
"You shouldn't have said that. You shouldn't have called me yellow."
"Then get on your feet. I hate to shoot a sittin' man."
"Have a drink and let's talk."
"Sure." Saber was elaborately casual.
"You have one, too."
He reached his hand for the glass that had already been poured, but McCarran's eyes were steady. Saber switched his hand and grasped the other glass, and then, like a striking snake, Prince McCarran grasped his right hand and jerked him forward, off balance. At the same time, McCarran's left flashed back to the holster high on his left side, butt forward, and the gun jerked up and free. Matt Saber, instead of trying to jerk his right hand free, let his weight go forward, following and hurling himself against McCarran. The chair went over with a crash, and Prince tried to straighten, but Matt was riding him back. He crashed into the wall, and Saber broke free. Prince swung his gun up, and Saber's left palm slapped down, knocking the gun aside and gripping the hand across the thumb. His right hand came up under the gun barrel, twisting it back over and out of McCarran's hands. Then he shoved him back and dropped the gun, slapping him across the mouth with his open palm. It was a free swing, and it cracked like a pistol shot. McCarran's face went white from the blow, and he rushed, swinging. But Saber brought up his knee in the charging man's groin. Then he smashed him in the face with his elbow, pushing him over and back. McCarran dived past him, blood streaming from his crushed nose, and grabbed wildly at the papers. His hand came up with a Bulldog 41. Matt saw the hand shoot for the papers, and even as the 41 appeared, His own gun was lifting. He fired first, three times, at a range of 4 feet. Prince McCarran stiffened, lifted to his tiptoes, then plunged over on his face and lay still among the litter of papers and broken glass. Saber swayed drunkenly. He recalled what Sykes had said about the desk. He caught the edge and jerked it aside, swinging the desk away from the wall. Behind it was a small panel with a knob. It was locked, but a bullet smashed the lock. He jerked it open. A thick wad of bills, a small sack of gold coins, a sheaf of papers. A glance sufficed. These were the papers Simpson had mentioned. The thick parchment of the original grant, the information on the conflicting Sonoma grant, and then... He glanced swiftly through them. Then, at a pound of horse's hoofs, he stuffed them inside his shirt. He stopped, stared. His shirt was soaked with blood. Fumbling, he got the papers into his pocket, then stared down at himself. Sykes had hit him. Funny, he had never felt it. Only a shock, a numbness. Now Reed was coming back. Catching up a sawed-off express shotgun, he started for the door, weaving like a drunken man. He never even got to the door. The sound of galloping horses was all he could hear. Galloping horses, and then a faint smell of something that reminded him of a time he had been wounded in North Africa. His eyes flickered open, and the first thing he saw was a room's wall with a picture of a man with mutton-chop whiskers and spectacles. He turned his head and saw Jenny Curtin watching him.
"So, you've decided to wake up. You're getting lazy, Matt, Mr. Saber. On the ranch, you always were the first one up."
He stared at her. She had never looked half so charming, and that was bad. It was bad because it was time to be out of here and on a horse. "How long have I been here?"
"Only about a day and a half. You lost a lot of blood."
"What happened at the ranch? Did Keyes get there in time?"
"Yes, and I stayed. The others left right away."
"You stayed?"
"The others," she said quietly, "went down the road about 2 miles. There were Camp Gordon, Tom Judson, Pepito, and Keyes. And Rado, of course. They went down the road while I stood out in the ranch yard and let them see me. The boys ambushed them."
"Was it much of a fight?"
"None at all. The surprise was so great that they broke and ran. Only 3 weren't able, and 4 were badly wounded."
"You found the papers, including the one about McCarran sending the 5,000 in marked bills to El Paso?"
"Yes," she said simply. "We found that. He planned on having Billy arrested and charged with theft. He planned that, and then if he got killed, so much the better. It was only you he didn't count on."
"No." Matt Saber stared at his hands, strangely white now. "He didn't count on me." So it was all over now. She had her ranch. She was a free woman, and people would leave her alone. There was only one thing left. He had to tell her. To tell her that he was the one who had killed her husband. He turned his head on the pillow. "One thing more," he began. "I..."
"Not now. You need rest."
"Wait. I have to tell you this. It's about... about Billy."
"You mean that you...
you were the one who..." "Yes, I..." He hesitated, reluctant at last to say it.
"I know. I know you did, Matt. I've known from the beginning, even without all the things you said."
"I talked when I was delirious?"
"A little. But I knew, Matt. Call it intuition, anything you like, but I knew. You see, you told me how his eyes were when he was drawing his gun. Who could have known that but the man who shot him?"
"I see." His face was white. "Then I'd better rest. I've got some traveling to do."
She was standing beside him. "Traveling? Do you have to go on, Matt? From all you said last night, I thought..." "I thought..." Her face flushed. Maybe you didn't want to travel anymore. Stay with us, Matt, if you want to. We would like to have you, and Billy's been asking for you. He wants to know where his spurs are.
After a while, he admitted, carefully, Well, I guess I should stay and see that he gets them. A fellow should always make good on his promises to kids, I reckon.
You'll stay, then? You won't leave?
Matt stared up at her. I reckon, he said quietly. I'll never leave unless you send me away.
She smiled and touched his hair. Then you'll be here a long time, Mathurin Sabre. A very long time.
This concludes the reading of Ride, You Tonto Raiders by Louis L'Amour. Copyright 1949 by Popular Publications, Inc. Copyright 2007 by Golden West Literary Agency. This book was read by Stefan Rudnicki. This unabridged recording was published by arrangement with Golden West Literary Agency and was produced in 2007 by Blackstone Audio, Inc., which holds the copyright. Neither this recording nor any portion of it may be reproduced or used for any purpose without prior written authorization from Blackstone Audio, Inc. If you would like to obtain a complete catalog of our titles or our monthly update telling you about new releases and our new collection of books on CD and MP3 CD, call 1-800-SAY-BOOK. That's 1-800-729-2665. You may also obtain the same information from our award-winning website. Our address, all one word, is www.blackstoneaudio.com. Thank you.
War Party by Louis L'Amour. We buried Pa on a side hill out west of camp. Buried him high up so his ghost could look down the trail he'd planned to travel. We piled the grave high with rocks because of the coyotes. And we dug the grave deep. And some of it I dug myself. And Mr. Sampson helped and some others. Folks in the wagon train figured Ma would turn back. But they hadn't known Ma so long as I had. Once she set her mind to something, she wasn't about to quit. She was a young woman and pretty, but there was strength in her. She was a lone woman with two children, but she was of no mind to turn back. She'd come through the Little Crow massacre in Minnesota, and she knew what trouble was. Yet it was like her that she put it up to me. "Bud," she said when we were alone, "we can turn back. But we've nobody there who cares about us, and it's of you and Jeannie that I'm thinking. If we go west, you will have to be the man of the house, and you'll have to work hard to make up for Pa." "We'll go west," I said. A boy those days took it for granted that he had work to do, and the men couldn't do it all. No boy ever thought of himself as only 12 or 13 or whatever he was, being anxious to prove himself and take a man's place and responsibilities. Ryerson and his wife were going back. She was a complaining woman, and he was a man who was always ailing when there was work to be done. 4 or 5 wagons were turning back, folks with their tails betwixt their legs running for the shelter of towns where their own littleness wouldn't stand out so plain. When a body crossed the Mississippi and left the settlements behind, something happened to him. The world seemed to bust wide open, and suddenly the horizons spread out, and a man wasn't cramped anymore. The pinched-up villages and the narrowness of towns, all that was gone. The horizons simply exploded and rolled back into the enormous distance, with nothing around but prairie and sky. Some folks couldn't stand it. They'd cringe into themselves and start hunting excuses to go back where they came from. This was a big country needing big men and women to live in it, and there was no place out here for the frightened or the mean. The prairie and sky had a way of trimming folks down to size, or changing them to giants to whom nothing seemed impossible. Men who had cut a wide swath back in the States found themselves nothing out here.
They were folks who were used to doing a lot of talking, who suddenly found that no one was listening anymore. And things that seemed mighty important back home, like family and money, they amounted to nothing alongside character and courage. There was John Sampson from our town. He was a man used to being told to do things, used to looking up to wealth and power. But when he crossed the Mississippi, he began to lift his head and look around. He squared his shoulders, put more crack to his whip, and began to make his own tracks in the land. Pa was always strong. An independent man, given to reading at night from one of the four or five books we had, to speaking up on matters of principle, and to straight shooting with a rifle. Pa had fought the Comanches and lived with the Sioux. But he wasn't strong enough to last more than 2 days with a Kiowa arrow through his lung. But he died knowing Ma had stood by the rear wheel and shot the Kiowa whose arrow was in him. Right then I knew that neither Indians nor country was going to get the better of Ma. Shooting that Kiowa was the first time Ma had shot anything but some chicken-killing varmint, which she'd done time to time when Pa was away from home. Only Ma wouldn't let Jeannie and me call it home. "We came here from Illinois," she said, "but we're going home now." "But Ma," I protested, "I thought home was where we came from." "Home is where we're going now," Ma said, "and we'll know it when we find it. Now that Pa is gone, we'll have to build that home ourselves." She had a way of saying home, so it sounded like a rare and wonderful place, and kept Jeannie and me looking always at the horizon, just knowing it was over there, waiting for us to see it. She had given us the dream, and even Jeannie, who was only 6, she had it too. She might tell us that home was where we were going, but I knew home was where Ma was, a warm and friendly place with biscuits on the table and fresh-made butter. We wouldn't have a real home until Ma was there and we had a fire going. Only I'd build the fire. Mr. Buchanan, who was captain of the wagon train, came to us with Tryon Burt, who was guide. "We'll help you," Mr. Buchanan said. "I know you'll be wanting to go back, and..." "But we are not going back," Ma smiled at them. "And don't be afraid we'll be a burden. I know you have troubles of your own, and we will manage very well." Mr. Buchanan looked uncomfortable, like he was trying to think of the right thing to say.
"Now, see here," he protested. "We started this trip with a rule. There has to be a man with every wagon."
Ma put her hand on my shoulder. "I have my man. Bud is almost 13 and accepts responsibility. I could ask for no better man." Ryerson came up. He was thin, stooped in the shoulder, and whenever he looked at Ma, there was a greasy look to his eyes that I didn't like. He was a man who looked dirty even when he'd just washed in the creek.
"You come along with me, ma'am," he said. "I'll take good care of you."
"Mr. Ryerson," Ma looked him right in the eye, "you have a wife who can use better care than she's getting, and I have my son."
"He's nothing but a boy."
"You are turning back, are you not? My son is going on. I believe that should indicate who is more the man. It is neither size nor age that makes a man, Mr. Ryerson, but something he has inside. My son has it." Ryerson might have said something unpleasant, only Tryon Burt was standing there wishing he would, so he just looked ugly and hustled off.
"I'd like to say you could come," Mr. Buchanan said, "but the boy couldn't stand up to a man's work."
Ma smiled at him, chin up, the way she had. "I do not believe in gambling, Mr. Buchanan, but I'll wager a good Ballard rifle there isn't a man in camp who could follow a child all day. Running when it runs, squatting when it squats, bending when it bends, and wrestling when it wrestles, and not be played out long before the child is."
"You may be right, ma'am, but a rule is a rule."
"We are in Indian country, Mr. Buchanan. If you are killed a week from now, I suppose your wife must return to the States?"
"That's different. Nobody could turn back from there."
"Then," Ma said sweetly, It seems a rule is only a rule within certain limits, and if I recall correctly, no such limit was designated in the Articles of Travel. Whatever limits there were, Mr. Buchanan, must have been passed some time before the Indian attack that killed my husband. I can drive the wagon and so can Ma, I said. For the past 2 days I've been driving, and nobody said anything until Pa died. Mr. Buchanan didn't know what to say, but a body could see he didn't like it, nor did he like a woman who talked up to him the way Ma did. Tryon Burt spoke up.
Let the boy drive. I've watched this youngster, and he'll do. He has better judgment than most men in the outfit, and he stands up to his work. If need be, I'll help.
Mr. Buchanan turned around and walked off with his back stiff the way it is when he's mad.
Ma looked at Bert, and she said,
Thank you, Mr. Bert. That was nice of you.
Try Bert. He got all red around the gills and took off like somebody had put a burr under his saddle.
Come morning, our wagon was the second one ready to take its place in line, with both horses saddled and tied behind the wagon, and me standing beside the off ox. Any direction a man wanted to look, there was nothing but grass and sky, only sometimes there'd be a buffalo wallow or a gopher hole. We made 11 miles the first day after Pa was buried, 16 the next, then 19, 13, and 21. At no time did the country change. On the sixth day after Pa died, I killed a buffalo. It was a young bull, but a big one, and I spotted him coming up out of a draw and was off my horse and belly down in the grass before Tri Burt realized there was game in sight. That bull came up from the draw and stopped there, staring at the wagon train, which was a half mile off. Setting a sight behind his left shoulder, I took a long breath, took in the trigger slack, then squeezed off my shot so gentle-like the gun jumped in my hands before I was ready for it. The bull took a step back like something had surprised him, and I jacked another shell into the chamber and was sighting on him again when he went down on his knees and rolled over on his side.
You got him, bud! Bert was more excited than I. That was shooting!
Tri got down and showed me how to skin the bull and lent me a hand. Then we cut out a lot of fresh meat and toted it back to the wagons. Ma was at the fire when we came up. A wisp of brown hair alongside her cheek and her face flushed from the heat of the fire, looking as pretty as a bay pony.
Bud killed his first buffalo, Bert told her, looking at Ma like he could eat her with a spoon.
Why, Bud, that's wonderful! Her eyes started to dance with a kind of mischief in them, and she said, Bud, why don't you take a piece of that meat along to Mr. Buchanan and the others? With Bert to help, we cut the meat into 18 pieces and distributed it around the wagons. It wasn't much, but it was the first fresh meat in a couple of weeks.
John Sampson squeezed my shoulder and said, Seems to me you and your ma are folks to travel with. This outfit needs some hunters.
Each night I staked out that buffalo hide, and each day I worked at curing it before rolling it up to pack on the wagon. Believe you me, I was some proud of that buffalo hide. Biggest thing I'd shot until then was a cottontail rabbit back in Illinois, where we lived when I was born. Tri Burt told folks about that shot. 200 yards, he'd say, right through the heart. Only it wasn't more than 150 yards, the way I figured, and Pa used to make me pace off distances so I'd learn to judge right. But I was nobody to argue with Tri Burt telling a story. Besides, 200 yards makes an awful lot better sound than 150. After supper, the men folks would gather to talk plans. The season was late, and we weren't making the time we ought if we hoped to beat the snow through the passes of the Sierras. When they talked, I was there because I was the man of my wagon, but nobody paid me no mind. Mr. Buchanan, he acted like he didn't see me, but John Sampson would, and Tri Burt always smiled at me. Several spoke up for turning back, but Mr. Buchanan said he knew of an outfit that made it through later than this. One thing was sure, our wagon wasn't turning back. Like Ma said, home was somewhere ahead of us, and back in the States we'd have no money and nobody to turn to, nor any relatives anywhere. It was the three of us.
"We're going on,"
I said at one of these talks. "We don't figure to turn back for anything." Webb gave me a glance full of contempt.
"You'll go where the rest of us go. You and your ma would play hop getting by on your own."
Next day it rained. Dawn to dark it fairly poured, and we were lucky to make 6 miles. Day after that, with the wagon wheels sinking into the prairie and the rain still falling, we camped just 2 miles from where we started in the morning. Nobody talked much around the fires, and what was said was apt to be short and irritable. Most of these folks had put all they owned into the outfits they had, and if they turned back now, they'd have nothing to live on and nothing left to make a fresh start, except a few like Mr. Buchanan, who was well off. "It doesn't have to be California," Ma said once. "What most of us want is land, not gold."
"This here is Indian country," John Sampson said, "and a sight too open for me. I'd like a valley in the hills, with running water close by."
"There will be valleys and meadows," Ma replied, stirring the stew she was making, "and tall trees near running streams, and tall grass growing in the meadows, and there will be game in the forest and on the grassy plains, and places for homes."
"And where will we find all that?" Webb's tone was slighting.
"West," Ma said, "over against the mountains."
"I suppose you've been there," Webb scoffed.
"No, Mr. Webb, I haven't been there, but I've been told of it. The land is there, and we will have some of it, my children and I, and we will stay through the winter, and in the spring we will plant our crops."
"Easy to say."
"This is Sioux country to the north," Bert said. "We'll be lucky to get through without a fight. There was a war party of 30 or 35 passed this way a couple of days ago."
"Sioux?"
"Uh-huh. No women or children along, and I found some war paint rubbed off on the brush."
"Maybe," Mr. Buchanan suggested, "we'd better turn south a mite."
"It is late in the season," Ma replied, "and the straightest way is the best way now."
"No use to worry," White interrupted. "Those Indians went on by. They won't likely know we're around."
"They were riding southeast," Ma said, "and their home is in the north. So when they return, they'll be riding northwest. There is no way they can miss our trail."
"Then we'd best turn back," White said.
"Don't look like we'd make it this year anyway," a woman said. "The season is late."
That started the argument, and some were for turning back, and some wanted to push on. And finally White said we should push on, but travel fast.
"Fast?" Webb asked disparagingly.
"An Indian can ride in 1 day the distance we'd travel in 4.
That started the wrangling again, and Ma continued with her cooking. Sitting there watching her, I figured I never did see anybody so graceful or quick on her feet as Ma. And when we used to walk in the woods back home, I never knew her to stumble or step on a fallen twig or branch. The group broke up and returned to their own fires, with nothing settled. Only there at the end, Mr. Buchanan looked to Bert. "Do you know the Sioux?"
"Only the Utes and Shoshones. I spent a winter on the Snake with the Nez Perces one time, but I've had no truck with the Sioux. Only they tell me they're bad medicine. Fighting men from way back, and they don't cotton to white folks in their country. If we run into Sioux, we're in trouble."
After Mr. Buchanan had gone, Tryon Burt accepted a plate and cup from Ma and settled down to eating. After a while, he looked up at her and said, "Begging your pardon, ma'am, but it struck me you knew a sight about tracking for an Eastern woman. You'd spotted those Sioux your own self, and you figured it right that they'd pick up our trail on the way back." She smiled at him.
"It was simply an observation, Mr. Burt.
I would believe anyone would notice it. I simply put it into words." Bert went on eating, but he was mighty thoughtful, and it didn't seem to me he was satisfied with Ma's answer. Ma said finally,
"It seems to be raining west of here. Isn't it likely to be snowing in the mountains?"
Bert looked up uneasily.
"Not necessarily so, ma'am. It could be raining here and not snowing there, but I'd say there was a chance of snow.
He got up and came around the fire to the coffee pot.
What are you getting at, ma'am?
Some of them are ready to turn back or change their plans.
What will you do then?
He frowned, placing his cup on the grass and starting to fill his pipe.
No idea. Might head south for Santa Fe. Why do you ask?
Because we're going on, Ma said. We're going to the mountains, and I am hoping some of the others decide to come with us.
You'd go alone?
He was amazed.
If necessary.
We started on at daybreak, but folks were more scary than before, and they kept looking at the great distances stretching away on either side and muttering. There was an autumn coolness in the air, and we were still short of South Pass by several days, with the memory of the Donner Party being talked up around us. There was another kind of talk in the wagons, and some of it I heard. The nightly gatherings around Ma's fire had started talk, and some of it pointed to try on Bert, and some were saying other things. We made 17 miles that day, and at night Mr. Buchanan didn't come to our fire. When White stopped by, his wife came and got him. Ma looked at her and smiled, and Mrs. White sniffed and went away beside her husband. Mr. Bert, Ma wasn't one to beat around a bush, is there talk about me? Try Bert got red around the ears and he opened his mouth, but couldn't find the words he wanted. Maybe. Well, maybe I shouldn't eat here all the time. Only, well, ma'am, you're the best cook in camp. Ma smiled at him.
I hope that isn't the only reason you come to see us, Mr. Bert.
He got redder than ever then and gulped his coffee and took off in a hurry. Time to time the men had stopped by to help a little, but next morning nobody came by. We got lined out about as soon as ever, and Ma said to me as we sat on the wagon seat, "Pay no attention, Bud. You've no call to take up anything if you don't notice it. There will always be folks who will talk, and the better you do in the world, the more bad things they will say of you. Back there in the settlement, you remember how the dogs used to run out and bark at our wagons?"
"Yes, Ma."
"Did the wagons stop?"
"No, Ma."
"Remember that, son. The dogs bark, but the wagons go on their way. And if you're going someplace, you haven't time to bother with barking dogs." We made 18 miles that day, and the grass was better, but there was a rumble of distant thunder, whimpering and muttering off in the canyons, promising rain. Webb stopped by, dropped an armful of wood beside the fire, and then started off. "Thank you, Mr. Webb," Ma said, "but aren't you afraid you'll be talked about?" He looked angry and started to reply something angry, and then he grinned and said, "I reckon I'd be flattered, Mrs. Miles." Ma said, "No matter what is decided by the rest of them, Mr. Webb, we are going on, but there is no need to go to California for what we want." Webb took out his pipe and tamped it. He had a dark devil's face on him, with eyebrows like you see on pictures of the devil. I was afraid of Mr. Webb. "We want land," Ma said, "and there is land around us. In the mountains ahead there will be streams and forests. There will be fish and game, logs for houses, and meadows for grazing." Mr. Buchanan had joined us. "That's fool talk," he declared. "What could anyone do in these hills? You'd be cut off from the world, left out of it." "A man wouldn't be so crowded as in California," John Sampson remarked. "I've seen so many go that I've been wondering what they all do there." "For a woman," Webb replied, ignoring the others, "you've a head on you, ma'am." "What about the Sioux?" Mr. Buchanan asked dryly.
"We'd not be encroaching on their land. They live to the north," Ma said.
She gestured toward the mountains. "There is land to be had just a few days farther on, and that is where our wagon will stop." A few days. Everybody looked at everybody else. Not months, but days only. Those who stopped then would have enough of their supplies left to help them through the winter, and with what game they could kill, and time for cutting wood and even building cabins before the cold set in. Oh, there was an argument. Such an argument as you've never heard, and the upshot of it was that all agreed it was fool talk, and the thing to do was keep going. And there was talk I overheard about Ma being no better than she should be, and why was that guide always hanging around her? And all those men? No decent woman. I hurried away. At break of day, our wagons rolled down a long valley with a small stream alongside the trail, and the Indians came over the ridge to the south of us and started our way. Tall, fine-looking men with feathers in their hair. There was barely time for a circle, but I was riding off in front with Tryon Burt, and he said, "A man can always try to talk first, and Injuns like a palaver. You get back to the wagons." Only I rode along beside him, my rifle over my saddle and ready to hand. My mouth was dry and my heart was beaten so's I thought Try could hear it. I was that scared. But behind us, the wagons were making their circle, and every second was important. Their chief was a big man with splendid muscles, and there was a scalp not many days old hanging from his lance. It looked like Ryerson's hair, but Ryerson's wagons should have been miles away to the east by now. Bert tried them in Shoshone, but it was the language of their enemies, and they merely stared at him, understanding well enough, but of no mind to talk. One young buck kept staring at Bert with a taunt in his eye, daring Bert to make a move. Then suddenly the chief spoke, and they all turned their eyes toward the wagons. There was a rider coming, and it was a woman. It was Ma. She rode right up beside us, and when she drew up, she started to talk, and she was speaking their language. She was talking Sioux. We both knew what it was because those Indians sat up and paid attention. Suddenly, she directed a question at the chief. "Red horse," he said in English. Ma shifted to English. "My husband was blood brother to Gall, the greatest warrior of the Sioux Nation. It was my husband who found Gall dying in the brush with a bayonet wound in his chest, who took Gall to his home and treated the wound until it was well."
"Your husband was a medicine man?" Red Horse asked.
"My husband was a warrior," Ma replied proudly. "But he made war only against strong men, not women or children or the wounded." She put her hand on my shoulder. "This is my son. As my husband was blood brother to Gall, his son is by blood brotherhood the son of Gall also." Red Horse stared at Ma for a long time, and I was getting even more scared. I could feel a drop of sweat start at my collar and crawl slowly down my spine. Red Horse looked at me.
"Is this one a fit son for Gall?"
"He is a fit son. He has killed his first buffalo." Red Horse turned his mount and spoke to the others. One of the young braves shouted angrily at him, and Red Horse replied sharply. Reluctantly, the warriors trailed off after their chief.
"Ma'am," Bert said, "you just about saved our bacon. They were just spoiling for a fight."
"We should be moving," Ma said.
"Mr. Buchanan was waiting for us. What happened out there? I tried to keep her back, but she's a difficult woman." "She's worth any three men in the outfit," Bert replied.
That day we made 18 miles, and by the time the wagon circled, there was talk. The fact that Ma had saved them was less important now than other things. It didn't seem right that a decent woman could talk Sioux or mix in the affairs of men. Nobody came to our fire. But while picketing the saddle horses, I heard someone say, "Must be part Injun. Why else would they pay attention to a woman? Maybe she's part Injun and leading us into a trap."
"Hadn't been for her," Bert said, "you'd all be dead now."
"How do you know what she said to him? Who savvies that lingo?"
"I never did trust that woman," Mrs. White said. "Too high and mighty. Nor that husband of hers either, comes to that. Kept to himself too much."
The air was cool after a brief shower when we started in the morning, and no Indians in sight. All day long we moved over grass made fresh by new rain, and all the ridges were pine-clad now, and the growth along the streams heavier.
Short of sundown, I killed an antelope with a running shot, dropped him mighty neat, and looked up to see an Indian watching from a hill. At the distance, I couldn't tell, but it could have been Red Horse. Time to time, I'd passed along the train, but nobody waved or said anything. Webb watched me go by, his face stolid as one of the Sioux, yet I could see there was a deal of talk going on. "Why are they mad at us?" I asked Bert. "Folks hate something they don't understand, or anything seems different. Your ma goes her own way, speaks her mind, and of an evening she doesn't set by and gossip." He topped out on a rise and drew up to study the country, and me beside him. You got to figure most of these folks come from small towns where they never knew much aside from their families, their gossip, and their church. It doesn't seem right to them that a decent woman would find time to learn Sioux. Bert studied the country. Time was any stranger was an enemy, and if anybody came around who wasn't one of yours, you killed them. And I've seen wolves jump on a wolf that was white or different somehow. Seems like folks and animals fear anything that's unusual. We circled, and I staked out my horses and took the oxen to the herd. By the time Ma had her grub box lid down, I was fixing at a fire, when here come Mr. Buchanan, Mr. and Mrs. White, and some other folks, including that Webb. "Ma'am," Mr. Buchanan was mighty abrupt, "we figure we ought to know what you said to those Sioux. We want to know why they turned off just because you went out there."
"Does it matter?"
Mr. Buchanan's face stiffened up.
"We think it does. There's some think you might be an Indian your own self."
"And if I am?" Ma was amused. "Just what is it you have in mind, Mr. Buchanan?"
"We don't want no Injuns in this outfit," Mr. White shouted.
"How does it come you can talk that language?" Mrs. White demanded. "Even Tryon Burt can't talk it."
"I figure maybe you want us to keep going because there's a trap up ahead," White declared.
I never realized folks could be so mean. But there they were, facing Ma like they hated her, like those witch hunters Ma told me about back in Salem. It didn't seem right that Ma, who they didn't like, had saved them from an Indian attack, and the fact that she talked Sioux like any Indian bothered them. "As it happens," Ma said, "I am not an Indian, although I should not be ashamed of it if I were. They have many admirable qualities. However, you need worry yourselves no longer as we part company in the morning. I have no desire to travel further with you gentlemen."
Mr. Buchanan's face got all angry, and he started up to say something mean. Nobody was about to speak roughly to Ma with me standing by, so I just picked up that old rifle and jacked a shell into the chamber.
"Mr. Buchanan, this here's my Ma, and she's a lady, so you just be careful what words you use."
"Put down that rifle, you young fool," he shouted at me.
"Mr. Buchanan, I may be little and may be a fool, but this here rifle doesn't care who pulls its trigger."
He looked like he was going to have a stroke, but he just turned sharply around and walked away, all stiff in the back. "Ma'am," Webb said,
"you've no cause to like me much, but you've shown more brains than that passel of fools. If you'll be so kind, me and my boy would like to trail along with you."
"I like a man who speaks his mind, Mr. Webb. I would consider it an honor to have your company."
Tryon Burt looked quizzically at Ma.
"Why now, seems to me this is a time for a man to make up his mind. And I'd like to be included along with Webb."
"Mr. Burt," Ma said, "for your own information, I grew up among Sioux children in Minnesota. They were my playmates." Come daylight, our wagon pulled off to one side, pointing northwest of the mountains, and Mr. Buchanan led off to the west. Webb followed Ma's wagon, and I sat watching Mr. Buchanan's eyes get angrier as John Sampson, Neely Stewart, the two Shafter wagons, and Tom Croft all fell in behind us.
Tryon Burt had been talking to Mr. Buchanan, but he left off and trotted his horse over to where I sat my horse. Mr. Buchanan looked mighty sullen when he saw half his wagon train gone, and with it, a lot of his importance as captain. 2 days, and nearly 40 miles farther, and we topped out on a rise and paused to let the oxen take a blow. A long valley lay across our route, with tall grass wet with rain, and a flat bench on the mountainside seen through a gray veil of a light shower falling. There was that bench, with the white trunks of aspen on the mountainside beyond it, looking like ranks of slim soldiers guarding the bench against the storms. "Ma," I said. "All right, Bud," she said quietly. "We've come home." And I started up the oxen and drove down into the valley where I was to become a man.
This concludes the reading of War Party by Louis L'Amour. Copyright 1959 by the Curtis Publishing Company. Copyright 2007 by Golden West Literary Agency. This book was read by Stefan Rudnicki. This unabridged recording was published by arrangement with Golden West Literary Agency and was produced in 2007 by Blackstone Audio, Inc., which holds the copyright. Neither this recording nor any portion of it may be reproduced or used for any purpose without prior written authorization from Blackstone Audio, Inc. If you would like to obtain a complete catalog of our titles or our monthly update telling you about new releases and our new collection of books on CD and MP3 CD, call 1-800-SAY-BOOK. That's 1-800-729-2665. You may also obtain the same information from our award-winning website. Our address, all one word, is www.blackstoneaudio.com. Thank you.